Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Poema podcast. I am James Prescott, your host. Welcome back to the show. Really great to have you all back here again. And today I have another returning guest for another in a kind of what is becoming an irregular series on this show. Jenna DeWitt is back, and we are talking about 1989 Taylor's version. So welcome back, Jenna.
Hello, everyone. It's so glad to be here.
Yeah, we've talked about quite a few Taylor Swift. I don't know how many episodes we've done on Taylor Swift now. I can't even remember. Yeah, this is too many. It must be like four or five at least. The last one we did was for the Midnight's album, which came out in 2022. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think so.
My word.
All the years kind of smushed together for me. So, you know, especially since 2019, it's like, yeah. What do you mean it's not still 2021? Like,
no, right? I know. Forever. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's genuinely bizarre. We're here for the 1989 Taylor's version. This is a very popular album already. The original was very popular. Amongst Swifties and just amongst people generally. This is one I wasn't really into Taylor Swift at the time, although I do remember being in an office and somebody in the desk next to me playing Shake It Off about six times a day. So I was every day and singing along with it at her desk. So it kind of got a bit annoying. So I never listened to this album. That's the only song I heard off the album until this version came out, because I was just like so annoyed by that song, hearing it all the time. And it's quite a fun song. It's just that when you hear it six times a day, 5 days a week, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we have both sides of the coin here, because I think that is a very common thing that people had to, you know, kind of put up with this annoying, cheesy pop album. And so that's kind of how they came to associate with Taylor, is like, oh my gosh, it's just this little girl music or teeny bopper music or whatever they would call it.
Yeah.
And not really serious, because that's all they were hearing was this, the earworm got repeated over and over on the radio. And even that song itself is good. It's just that the context in which people were introduced to her music wasn't really conducive to people enjoying it.
Hmm.
So that I think it became a problem that she was so popular. So that's kind of the theme of what we'll get into some in this episode.
Yeah, because this album, it's called 1989. I think that's the year that Taylor was born, correct?
Yes, yeah.
And that's probably, but I think that's why it's called 1989. It's a very good album. I think obviously the Taylor's version is better than the original, which seems to be the case with most of the Taylor's versions so far. And there's some extra tracks on this album as well, which are very, very good, and we'll get to those later. What does this? What, like? I mean, obviously you're a massive Swiftie, right? So, what does this album mean to you? Like the original version, and also obviously the Taylor's version.
Yeah. So I would say the album originally came out in 2014. And if you think back to like where you were in 2014, like all the changes that were about to happen, we're having gay marriage become legalized in a lot of different states. So, it was becoming a huge national debate. We had, it was kind of the wind down of the Obama years. It was just a different world that we lived in then, that, it was a big deal when we had mass shootings in the US, and now it's just kind of daily news, and that's tragic. But it's like so much of this kind of rose-colored lenses of the world that we lived in were taken off so soon after this. So it was a really culturally iconic moment. But this album in particular, I personally was like, this was the first one I was really counting down for. I had been a fan since the Country days, in the sense of like I was familiar with all her music and I'd listened to it and I have associations with it. But this was the first one that I was really excited about a Taylor album coming out as a Swiftie. In fact, I was even worried about playing it too much and getting tired of it myself because I loved it so much. And I think like even from that very beginning of in my life, I was about 3 years out of college and living on my own for the first time in that apartment, and kind of having that welcome to New York vibe. I wasn't in a New York situation, but I was in Birmingham, Alabama, which is not the same. You're free, you're safe, you're okay. And a lot of ways I wasn't, because I was still involved in a toxic system that you know, it's hard to break out of these things, and it's hard to get treatment for mental illness, and it's hard to really find true freedom and satisfaction as a single person in a world that tells you you need to be in relationships. So there was a lot that I really wasn't free. And I think we see that paralleled in Taylor's story as well, is that she's advocating for all these tight-knit female friendships and having all these connections and, you know, just all of these things that she is standing up for the first time or making statements about. And then we've seen over the last 10 years how, like, she's really had to learn those lessons and earn that and has discovered new depths of the things that she was talking about on the 1989 world tour in her speeches before songs. And it's like, oh, honey, like, you don't even know. Like, the summer of 2015, you're saying these things. And here now, I believe in 2024, she's had the lived experience, and so have I, to really be able to mean them in a new depth, in a new way. So that's exciting with this Taylor version, is that a lot of what was aspirational then is now something that is more lived wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting arc for any creative person, is when you do that, when you're literally kind of telling your story about your aspirations in one album, and then, you know, 10 years later, you've lived all of them, and you're re-recording those songs from a place of, I've actually lived this now, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a different energy behind recording a song when you've lived it than when it's an aspiration. And that's why this Taylor's version is so interesting, because I can hear that depth. You know, I can hear there's a different energy behind this version, especially the new tracks. I mean, the new tracks are, there's a couple that we'll talk about, but that felt like, I had the kind of depth of things like stuff from Folklore and from the Red Taylor's version as well. Like there's somehow a new depth to Taylor's music now, which we've seen in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years at least. And you can hear it for sure. Yeah. Even the Shake It Off song is different. You know, there's like a, I wouldn't say maybe more of a heaviness, but not a, I don't want to say heaviness in the wrong way, but there's more of a depth to it than a.
Yeah. A gravitas. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. That's the word. That's the word. Yeah.
And I think because she has shaken off a lot of these things, you know, that she came across so much more criticism because of this album and that the fame that it propelled her into, that before writing it, you know, wasn't necessarily in that bright of a spotlight. Like, she was in the spotlight, but not as bright as it got after the Shake It Off album was released, you know, this track was released. So she talks in this Miss Americana documentary, which I highly recommend everyone watching.
Oh, I've seen that. It's brilliant. Yeah, absolutely.
And we've talked about it before in another podcast on this show, but she was going through a lot of like darkness in this era, an eating disorder, a lot of internal problems. And outwardly at the time, she appears so confident. She's got all these huge friends and these brand deals and success, and she is everywhere. She's in Capital One commercials, and you know, she's got all this like soda commercials, and you know, like things that she's her face is just all over the place. And so she appears super confident and perfect and everything. But we know now that she shared that under the surface there was a lot going on there.
Absolutely. I think that's always the case, isn't it, with people who are very public and have an image to cultivate and have to sell records and have to do the work. But also underneath, there's always things going on underneath. I think if it appears absolutely perfect on the surface, it probably isn't perfect underneath.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Like, you know, that's a struggle for anyone who's in the spotlight. A lot is that, you know, how much of yourself do you give away? How do you remain authentic and yet not overshare and not be too overly vulnerable? Because there is, I think there's got to be a balance of like keeping certain things private and dealing with things with, you know, your close friends and people that you trust and your inner circle and obviously therapists if necessary and all of that, and keeping that private, but at the same time trying to be your authentic self in public as well. Like, that is, I don't envy I don't envy people who have to do that. I really don't. It must have been a real challenge for Taylor.
Mm-hmm. And building that brand of authenticity too, when that's like what people are holding you accountable toward.
Absolutely.
But I really appreciate where that brand took her, because she even says it's one of her greatest songs of all time is Blank Space. And I think that is like the pivotal song of this album. So at the time, everybody was thinking it was Shake It Off because that was the lead single and that's what everybody knew, or Welcome to New York as being the starting track of the album. But I think Blank Space is the one that it really goes down as one of the best pop songs of all time. That's not just me saying that. That's, you know, critics everywhere are saying that 1989 is an album, but then also specifically Blank Space is her magnum opus. Like, this is what the people are going to remember her for in pop music history. But it's so important because it's a song of satire, that she was hearing all these media criticisms about who she was dating and how she was just this, you know, going out there and taking these men and tearing them down and all these sort of things. And she's like, well, it's not true, but how interesting would it be to write a song from that perspective if it were, you know, like writing this character that people had made her out to be. And I think that's just genius. Like, taking this song and satirizing this person people had built her up to be, instead of writing how, like, you know, screw the haters, that we did with Shake It Off is great, but it's not just like, y'all don't really know me. It's coming out and saying like, wow, this is a really interesting person. Thank you for that fuel. I'm going to take this and I'm going to make more money off of this than anything else, you know?
Yeah. And I love that crazy song. I love that song. And I didn't know it was on this album until much later on. Yeah. Because I think that was one of the songs that, like, wow, this is really, really good. Like, yeah. And you're right. It is absolutely using the energy of, I think Bono once said, you've got to use the energy that's coming to destroy you to defend yourself. Like, so anything, all this kind of negative energy is coming towards her. And then she doesn't just kind of try to attack it. She uses that energy and uses that energy to kind of to defend herself. And in a very brilliant way, that song is really, really good. And the lyrics are incredible. It's always the lyrics with Taylor, like, for me. I mean, I guess I'm a writer, so I always look at lyrics more than just the melodies and things. And like, the songs that I love the most are the ones with great lyrics. And you'd be surprised at what songs have really great lyrics. And Taylor is a brilliant lyricist. She tells stories in her songs, and then she tells stories in her songs individually, but also collectively as an album, she tells a story. And that's part of her genius is that, like, to, you know, to make every song an individual story, but also to make each album a collective story. And that is, that's very powerful.
Yeah. And reclaiming your power in the sense of, like, instead of being the joke, being the comedian, like the one who's actually telling the joke. Cause if I'm the one who's in power telling the joke, then, like, it's not, you don't have any power over me. You know, like, I'm the one who's in charge here. And I think that's really important and really powerful. And, you know, part of the criticism of what she was getting was about her romantic relationships and who she was dating and all the criticism around that. Particularly around this era, she had a relationship with very popular Harry Styles, who now, of course, is popular as a solo artist, but at the time was part of this boy band One Direction.
Yep.
And so everybody was talking on the internet about how they hated her simply because she was with the man that they wanted to be with, or that they wanted to be with someone else, or wanted to be with one of the band members. And so all this fandom stuff got really highly criticizing her simply for dating the wrong person and dating somebody that they wanted to be with. And so it's interesting that she decides to be the one in power by putting Style on this album.
Mm.
And so obviously Style is a song about Harry Styles, but it's playing off of his name, saying, like, you know, we're never going to go out of style. And the fashion of the red lipstick and the tight skirt and the long hair and the, you know, like, all the descriptions of these people. But, you know, what's really funny is that my friends in the church world, our favorite lyric from Style, it was, I've got that good girl faith. So one of the song lyrics is, I've got that good girl faith and that tight little skirt. And we're like, oh, good. Like, it's okay for us to listen to her. No one is going to tell us we're not allowed to because, you know, Wildest Dreams is another track on this album. Got a little sexy. You know, she's getting a little grown up. And so, you know, she still wasn't like cursing or anything. But for the most part, she was trying to be this good girl. And as a fellow good girl in a high control environment, we felt that all of our favorites had to be Christians, even if they were making secular pop music.
Yeah.
And so it made us okay for her to like her because she has this lyric of, oh yeah, she's still a Christian. She's got that good girl faith, even if she's got the tight skirt on too. And so it's like, oh, well, maybe we can do both. Maybe we can, you know, have what we want and pursue our desires and be strong women and still be part of this environment where it was very controlling. And so I think we've all spent the last 10 years breaking out of that and discovering that high control environment of like, oh, well, at least she's a Christian. And like, as long as she says she's a Christian, anything she does is okay, you know, and we've all kind of gotten out of that, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. But I remember that. That whole thing of like trying desperately to find evidence that your favorite artist was a Christian or had some faith or whatever, you know, it was like a thing, I think, in the church. And of course, we've been on the journey as well. We've had our own journey, like, and now obviously there's an element of like, well, that lyric means something different now, It's amazing how that happens, you know, with art, that like you can like the same music, but it can change what it means to you. You know, it was there's a lot of albums that I've loved for years, and as I've changed, what those songs mean to me has changed, and that's powerful. And that's a sign that's good music when it doesn't become outdated and like think, oh, I don't listen to that anymore because it doesn't mean anything to me. But when a song can evolve with you, that's powerful. And of course Taylor does that naturally because she's re-recorded all her past albums or re-recording her past albums, and so it's new even though it's old, and it's being recorded now from wherever she is now, and which just adds to that. So and certainly a lot of these songs are still very powerful today.
Indeed. I remember, you know, it brings up that living in a higher control environment, whether it's the music industry and the public scrutiny in the media or a big social media platform or your leadership in an organization, but particularly in those, you know, high control church environments, is anxiety. And she's talking about how in the Grammy Museum, she's performing live at this piano and talking about Out of the Woods. And she's like, the reason she wrote this song is like, and it's so repetitive, is because it's these ruminating thoughts of anxiety. I was like, are we out of the woods yet? Are we out of the woods? Like, that's the question that she's asking, is, are we out of the woods yet? And that's so relatable, like not on a romantic level for me, because, you know, I don't experience that, but says the anxiety part of, and especially this epic iconic bridge about leaving someone because you want to set them free. And so like, it's too dangerous to be around me because I am holding you back or I'm a burden to you. And that's just so real. And sometimes those monsters do turn out to be just trees. And then like leaning into that woods metaphor, but not always. Sometimes those fears were telling us something like, this is not a healthy relationship or this is not a healthy community to be part of. And you have to get out of that. So that's sometimes what it takes, is someone to be willing to be with us in the fear and still be there in the morning. You know, she talks about in the song, like, you're looking at me when like the sunrise happens, and like, here's the light of the morning, and we got through the metaphorical night, and you're still here with me. And I think some people experience that through their faith. Some people experience it through their friends or their romantic relationships or their family relationships. But being able to walk through that anxiety and get out of that toxic system, and then who is still left around you. And those are the people that you can really count on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the story of so many people who come through, you know, what we call deconstruction, is that you've come through a toxic, controlling environment and system, and you come out the other side, and there's some people that are left who are still with you and who are your community, and you discover new community. And there's some that you just leave behind and you don't see again. And I think that that resonates a lot with a lot of people, resonates with me, you know. It's like the, you know, the personal journey and the deconstruction journey, and it's all connected. I mean, like, you know, I think deconstruction is a good term, but it's a, I think it's a limited term in terms of growth, because I think like this story that we keep hearing is a lot of people's story of growth and healing and transformation. And it goes beyond just faith. It goes into identity. It goes into sexuality. It goes into, you know, all different areas of your life. And this song is, yeah, that lyric you're talking about, completely, yeah, it embodies a lot of that. I think that's why Taylor became more popular, because in the early 2020s, is because a lot of people were deconstructing at that point, and a lot of her songs were messages for people who were on that journey. I empathize that folklore, especially for me, was massive in my journey. A lot of those songs spoke right into my story and what I was experiencing and how I was growing and unlearning things and being set free from things. That's why I love that album, because it was very much speaking right into that. And I'm sure that I'm not alone in that, because there's a lot of other people who were on the same journey and still are. And I think that's one of the appeals of Taylor. She's kind of been on her own journey. And we don't know if it's a deconstruction journey. We don't know about her faith or anything, but she's clearly been on a personal transformation journey, and we've seen that in her music. And that's at the same time, a lot of other people are. So it's, yeah, there's a big connection there.
For a deeper dive on Taylor Swift and deconstruction, see our episode about You're Losing Me, because we did talk about this on a previous podcast where we compared similar song with Taylor's song, yes, and different ways of deconstruction. But I think that's, you can start to see a little bit of that here. And I think in my own life around this time in our 20s, because Taylor and I are the same age, I was also born in 1989. And so it's fun growing up alongside her and having these soundtracks to my own life as well as to Taylor's life.
Yeah, that's got to be amazing. You know, especially when it comes to like dates and ages and years and things, because the significant ones for Taylor will be ones for you, the same for you. You know, mm-hmm. like, so, you know, when she gets to her 40th birthday, it'll be your 40th birthday, you know, for example. So that's powerful. I like that. Yeah. And you're right. You know, in one of our podcasts, we have talked about this before. That was a great point. That was a great show. We literally looked at two songs and we covered a whole episode with two songs. One of them was a Taylor Swift song. I think that's the last one we did, possibly, was it? Because we did Midnights as well, but I don't know which one came first. But you can go and check them out. I'll try and create a playlist maybe of all the Taylor Swift episodes that we've done of this podcast on Spotify.
That'd be so fun.
Which would be really, really cool, you know. So, and who knows, maybe one day Taylor will listen to one of them. So anyway, that'd be fun. But so of the newer tracks, the kind of the unreleased ones, what ones kind of stood out for you?
I think the one that generated the most buzz of these vault tracks that were released is one called Slut. And so, of course, everyone thought that Slut with all caps and an exclamation point was going to be this, yeah, girl power, take back the narrative, you know, like you people are so mean to me kind of track. And it wasn't. It was this very soft kind of song. It was sonically, it's... just so romantic and genuine that it's like, hey, it's worth it. Even if everybody says this is a doomed relationship, this is, you know, this garden is full of thorns, to use her language, that it's still worth it because they can call me whatever names they want to. And I might as well just lean into it because I'm so in love with this person. And she's saying it's worth it to endure criticism and name calling. It's not angry, it's accepting. It's tragic, of course, that she would have to go through that, but I think there's a level of maturity there that maybe isn't when you see like Mean, which is fun. I do love the song Mean, but it's not about that. It's not about clapbacks. It's about staying focused on what's worth to her and on her own worth as a person. And for me, that's not about romance. It's about queerness and about asexuality and aromanticism. Maybe on the opposite, it seems like the opposite if you look at the surface, but women just face that criticism no matter what. If you don't have sex, or at least if you talk about not having sex, you're a prude, you're an ice queen, you're boring, you're a loser, you know, whatever. But if you do, you're called a slut. And there's no winning outside of that. I use sort of a motto normativity. I hear a lot, just like this idea that like you have to be in this perfect long-term committed relationship. And if you date more than one person, you're a slut. But if you don't date at all, then you're a prude and you just can't win in this this world that we've set up for women. And so it's really interesting to me that supposedly she was thinking of this in 2014. And I don't know that she would have had the maturity or courage or media platform or whatever to be able to put out a song with the word slut in the title, because back then we were just all like, is it okay to curse or not? And Taylor isn't cursing, so she must be a good girl. And so we had very, what seem very restrictive now, what we considered mainstream okayness. But, you know, the point is, people can say whatever they want. It's not going to keep me from being proudly myself and knowing what's worth it to me. And whether that's for Taylor, it's a romantic relationship. For me, it's not having one. I think that can be any, you know, you can fluctuate between those in your life too, that, you know, I may at some point be really proud of having a relationship with a woman. And even though it's not my story right now, the song will come to mean something else to me as we evolve in our lives. And I think that's true of a lot of these tracks.
Yeah. I love that. I like this track as well. And for the same reasons, it's about honest, but basically kind of saying, this is who I am. This is my story. This is my identity. And I am not ashamed of it. And that's a powerful message for everyone, you know? I just love that. And again, it's part of her journey, isn't it? That she couldn't say this 10 years ago, but she can say it now. And she can say it now because she's actually lived it out for 10 years, right? Maybe back then if she'd said it wouldn't have had the same weight, but now she can say it and really mean it because she's lived it, which makes the song more powerful. You know, there's always... Mm-hmm. So maybe it's good that we waited 10 years for this song because, yeah... I think it's a powerful message about empowerment, you know, and so much of what Taylor does is empowering. And I don't know whether she intends it that way, but it certainly is very empowering. And I've noticed, especially for female presenting people that it's especially empowering, and that's amazing. I mean, that's what a gift to be able to do that, you know. One of the songs that I loved, I absolutely love this song. Now That We Don't Talk. This song, I listened to this song like two or three times in a row. When I first heard the album, it was for me, it was kind of, there were so many layers to this song. It was about saying goodbye to past versions of myself. It was saying goodbye to toxic communities that I've been part of. It was saying goodbye to people that had kind of left me behind, you know, who got left behind on my journey. And just, you know, but actually reminding myself of why I don't talk to those people, why I'm not in community with those people anymore. It was kind of asserting myself a little bit, like, this is who I am now. This is where I am now. And I'm not going back. I'm not going to become that person again that you want me to be just so that I can be friends with you. I'm going to be who I am, and you can then choose to be in community with me or not. And if you're not, then we won't talk. And so there was a lot of my story in this song, like, and again, it was a reminder, just a reminder of growth, and that growth can be sometimes to be difficult, but it's necessary.
Yeah.
And what was this song about for you?
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing, is that it's so freeing to not be in this relationship anymore. I don't have to pretend to like the things you like. I don't have to, like, you know, be interested in what you're interested in. But it's so hard to break that relationship too. And so, and whether it's friendship or platonic or, you know, like the romantic stuff, it's, or community or anything, I think, like, we can be sad about a relationship ending, but also feel the relief in it, and that it's okay to have that paradox. It's okay to have that dichotomy. And we see the friendship, like, she was really clear that, like, Bad Blood, which is, of course, a huge, huge track from this album as well, got a second version released with Kendrick Lamar. And so, wait, was Kendrick Lamar? No, it's, yeah, wait, I can't remember who who's featuring Kendrick, right? anyway, so I want to get that name right just in case.
Yeah.
We can cut that. Sorry. But, you know, this album, like, has the friendship, and it has, yeah, it was Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we see this other version of it too coming out, and it's like got this music video featuring Kendrick Lamar and featuring all of these celebrities about this big celebrity friendship breakup with Katy Perry for over some tour drama her dancers.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and so this is huge, huge, high profile stuff. You've got high profile feature, you've got high profile stars in this music video, got high profile drama that it's about. And these girl squad and everything. But what's really sad is that, you know, she's producing this music video for Bad Blood, and a lot of these relationships broke. So, like, a lot of these people that were in this video and standing by her and everything in this feud with Katy Perry or whatever are not her friends anymore. And she is friends with Katy now again. They reconciled, and mm-hmm. Katy's been in one of her music videos for Lover. And so after all this, there was the Kim and Kanye drama, there was Scooter Braun and selling her masters, and that led to the re-recordings in the first place, and lots more criticism that came her way about whether she's too political or not political enough, or, you know, being a bad feminist or too feminist. So she gets all this criticism on every side, and it's amazing to see that originally in 2014, this album, like, very much centered around this Bad Blood, and I've got my girl squad, and they're all going to stand by me, and these men too as well. But then some of those people, those relationships didn't last, and sometimes we have the reconciliation of relationships that, you know, before were the catalyst for some of that girl squad gossip, let's all team up kind of thing. And so I think Now That We Don't Talk comes back around to this being like this retrospective on a relationship. That's from a completely different angle of, like, yeah, I'm grateful for the things that, like, I let go of with letting go of this relationship, but, like, it's okay to also, like, feel the ache about it too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a bit of grieving in there, isn't there? The kind of, you know, I'm sad these relationships have ended. I'm sad that I don't have these people in my life anymore, but I'm not ashamed of it, and I'm not going to go back. Mm-hmm. I'm again, it's empowerment. I'm proud of where I am as a person and how I've grown and how I'm still growing, and of the people in my life now, and of how my life is now. And I'm not going to go back. But I also know these relationships meant something to me, and so I'm going to have to grieve that as part of my journey. And that's the whole kind of, that's a lot of life is like that. You know, you're grieving things that are. When you're doing lots of transitions in life, when you're moving house, or you're moving jobs, or like you're ending relationships and maybe starting new relationships, or like any kind of life transition, there's a grieving, even if it's a good thing that you're leaving behind, or even if you're leaving it behind for the right reasons, because you're letting go of something that's been part of your life for a long time and that did mean something to you in the past, even if it doesn't mean as much to you now. So there's still that kind of grieving, and that's the tone of this song is very much like that. There's kind of an anger, but there's also kind of a deeper kind of sadness as well. Which is kind of what grief is. There's a lot of anger in grief, and there's a lot of sadness in grief as well. That's why I love that song, because it's just, I love any song like that that kind of conveys those kind of emotions, because we need more songs like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you talked about when we chatted before we started recording, we were talking about how a lot of this album sounds like a happy album in places. You know, it sounds like a, you know, joyful, poppy album, whatever. But there's actually a lot of underlying depth and conflict and grief and things like that under the surface. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think the track that really stands out to me in that aspect is Clean. And so it's just musically, I love Imogen Heap's contributions to this. Lyrically, I feel like, for me, like, it's not about a romantic relationship so much as about like the journey of leaving a church or a community or a friend group or anything that you loved, but that was harmful to you. Mm. And that could be anything, but I think a lot of listeners to this show will be able to relate to that feeling of building something that seemed really beautiful, but those flowers died of thirst because it wasn't what you thought you were investing in. Like, you put all your flowers into it and they were not being nurtured or watered. And so we got this huge water metaphor in the song, the months of back and forth, trying to discern, is this a place to stay? Should I change it? Do I need to get out? Like, is that the coward's way out? You know? Mm. And I appreciate too, that this is like a retrospective song. So whereas like, is it over now is kind of this new vault track is kind of like, is it over now? Like, was it over when you slept with someone else? Was it over when I slept with someone else? Like, where are we in this thing? We don't know. But mm-hmm. Clean is like, no, we're done. Like, I'm looking back now. I've grieved. I'm done with that process of grieving. And we're no longer struggling with this metaphorical addiction to this toxic relationship. So you might still miss it. Obviously, it's just because you're clean doesn't mean you don't miss it. You miss the community. Maybe you miss the easy answers they had, the belonging, the certainty, the resources and groups and support, but you're not running back because you know it's worth it to leave. You know, it wasn't worth it to stay. So, and along with the water metaphor, because a lot of us are going to relate to this on a church level. Mm. Isn't she wonderful? She's so great. Yes, but like is. We could say it's like a baptism, really. It's like you're being baptized into this community of outcasts, into the wilderness, into the deconstruction, the wanderers, being baptized by your own tears and emerging clean from that. And she said in the speech on the 1989 world tour that she hopes the listener can see what they're not. Like, you are not your mistakes. You are not what other people say about you. But you are wiser and you are stronger because you went through something terrible. So in a way, that's what the song is about as well, is that resilience that develops. Not like, oh, everything happens for a reason, but like, you've known pain. You know the storm. And so that's a lesson from 2014 we can take into 2024, is to like lean into that grief process, feel our feelings and let them wash away that dust and debris of broken promises and disappointments of who someone turned out to be that we didn't think they were going to disappoint us. And here now we are, you know, crying ourselves clean and we emerge stronger and wiser on the other side. Even if we still miss it sometimes, if we're honest with ourselves.
I mean, I love that metaphor. The water metaphor is always a good one. It's always a good one. Mm-hmm. And the crying yourself clean is I mean, that is just so powerful. I remember listening to that and thinking about how, you know, when I've been grieving, how there were so many tears, but that I was, you know, that those tears were tears of healing. They were releasing things from my body. They were releasing grief. They were releasing trauma. They were healing to my wounds. So my tears washed away those wounds. Well, they didn't wash them away, but they healed them. I mean, you carry scars with you your whole life. I think internally and externally, but that's such an incredible metaphor, and I just, again, that's another one I listen to a lot because it means so much to my story, you know. And the lyrics, it's always the lyrics that mm-hmm. get me, you know. I feel like, you know, we connect with them so powerfully, don't we? So yeah, that's another really, really good song. Go on.
I was gonna say, kind of just looking at the album as a whole, So it's kind of amazing, like looking back retrospectively on what impact did this have? And did people get those lyrics, or like, were they just taking it for, you know, media and popularity and, you know, that sort of thing? It's like, it is amazing how she's writing about grief and she's writing about how she feels things so deeply. And then people are coming at her for writing that. Like, it became profitable to write negative things about Taylor Swift. It became like professional publications were paying people to write gossip and criticism about her because that's what would sell online, especially.
Yeah, horrible.
So of course that was already happening as the motive for Blank Space, but it gets worse and worse through the Reputation album is the next album that comes after this. And so she really goes deep into this hole and isn't seen for a while because she's so popular. There's too many people who like her that it then becomes profitable to tear her down.
Yeah, and it is interesting that the Reputation is the next album, because that was the album that really caught me into Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. And the lyric of, and we can talk about this in another podcast for sure, but Taylor can't come to the phone right now because she's dead. And I was like, that lyric was like, that came out just as I was right in the middle of deconstruction, like right in the raw, like grief of it, like and it was like that. Ever since then, that lyric has meant like so much to me. It's like, oh yeah, this is it. You know, your old self dies. You let go of the old self, the self that you gave to the world. The kind of public self that you had, the self that you had for the church, the whatever. Like, and you just become yourself. You become your real self, and that's I think that's why that album connected with me, because it felt like, oh, this is actually Taylor Swift. This isn't like fake. This isn't like media. This isn't like an image. This is really her. Like, and I think I connected with that. And that's kind of where I started getting into Taylor Swift, because I think that album was a route in. And it's interesting that it comes straight after this one. That's very, very interesting in terms of, I wonder if she'll do a Taylor's version of that one. Oh, I'd like
to hear. Wait, oh yes, you will. Yeah. So that's the last one's after Reputation and her debut album that was a self-titled album. And so all she has left to re-record, this is so powerful metaphorically, are her Reputation and her name. That's the last thing she has to reclaim. It's her Reputation and her name. Isn't that amazing? But she won't do one of Lover or Folklore or Evermore, because those she already owns. And so like, weird question now is it going to be Taylor Swift, the debut album, or is it going to be Reputation next? And so everybody keeps saying like, oh, she's about to announce Reputation. She's about to announce Reputation. So if anybody says to you like, well, you know, she's about to release it. And it's like, no, just like, hold on. It doesn't happen till it happens, because there's been so many false internet. So that was my first note originally, was like, no, don't get into this whole Easter egg thing. Cause people keep thinking she's hinting about it, and then they get disappointed because she's not really releasing it tomorrow or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the Taylor's version of that will definitely be a podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think that was the beginning of, this season of her creative life. And now she's going back and looking at that again. And that's going to be really, really interesting for me.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. it'll be amazing. Well, and you know, speaking of popularity of this, like, it's a complicated album, right? Because you've got accolade after accolade, but then you've also got people saying she didn't deserve it. So like, I mean, this just happens with Taylor over and over again, is that with her Reputation, you know, is that this album beat out Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly for album of the year at the Grammys, but Kendrick was also featured on Bad Blood. And so it's like, you know, this album is like, part of the success of this album is Kendrick, but like, even people at the time were saying like, how dare you, like, award album of the year to this cheesy pop album when there was such more culturally important work happening at the time. And it's like, yeah, like, that's not what the artists themselves are saying. Like, people try to pit Taylor against Beyonce and like, they're friends. And like, you know, people are constantly trying to like say, how dare you recognize Taylor Swift when there's so much better, more important, or whatever, serious music out there. And these rock musicians, or, you know, everyone from Stevie Nicks and Carole King and Mick Jagger, and you've got all these legends who were like, no, no, we back Taylor. Like, we're on her side. And so it's just kind of crazy how, like, she did it right. She's networking with the right people and caring about those people's opinions of her, whereas, like, she's not necessarily chasing after every music critic out there that says, like, oh, well, this music is just silly because it was written by a little girl who's now in her 30s. And so,
I'm Peter Pan turning 35 this year, you know. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. So am I. So it's just really interesting how history then provides validation, because 10 years later, you've got all these critics saying it's not only her most important album, but one of the most pop, most influential pop albums of the decade or of all time. That you look at, like, Rolling Stone or The Times or, you know, Pitchfork or whatever, and you're seeing all of these, like, reader voted on polls saying, what are the most influential albums of all time? What are the most, the best pop music ever? And 1989 is constantly showing up on those lists.
Yeah.
And so these critics that, on the one hand, there's these pop culture critics that say, like, ew, Taylor Swift, how could you like her? But then you've got these music critics who are also saying, like, this is spawning new words like poptimism or retrofuturism, or it's kind of, and poptimism, like, really is defeating that. Very popular at the time was this hipster thing where it was like, we've got to be authentic. How could you like popular things? If it's mainstream, it's cringe, you know? And there's this movement that comes up with poptimism of, like, if everyone's joining something communally, like, that interconnectedness is this moment. I don't think we really see that fully realized to its full potential until this year with the Eras Tour, because you see this, like, cultural unifier with the Eras Tour of, like, people coming together and being unashamed about something that they enjoy. And that's something Taylor says all the time too, is that love what you love, being passionate about things and genuine about that, being honest about that you work hard and you want recognition for that and you want things in life, you have ambition, have loud joy, have desire and heartache and be a super fan. And all those things are seen as uncool or even offensive in our culture. You're not allowed to, like, really want things or show that you worked hard or talk about it. It has to just come easy to you and you gotta be cool about it and, oh, whatever, it doesn't matter. But what if instead we refuse to be shamed for feeling things deeply and refuse to be shamed for being enthusiastic and for being proud of our work and of our friends' work and promoting it? And, you know, I think we'd actually have more authenticity, not less, when we reject performative cynicism and that cool girl aesthetic or that chill macho guy who's just like, ooh, whatever, like, I don't care about anything. Like, that's not cool. What's cool is that, like, you care about what you do and you work hard at it. I just think that would make the world a better place.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been fun. I always enjoy these conversations. And I always learn more about the music when I talk to you about Taylor Swift. So it's fantastic. It's fantastic to talk to you about it again. And I know we'll be back again doing another one of these for absolute sure. Like, so keep your eyes out. It all depends on when Taylor decides to release the next one. Honestly,
that's true.
That's literally exactly. It. So only Taylor Swift knows when the next one will come, when the next one of these will come. But it'll probably be this year sometime, I suspect. And of course, she could drop a new album, of course, just out of the blue again, like she did before.
Nothing's faster. Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot of speculation, which I think is probably somewhat true, is that she started recording these vault tracks for 1989, and she and Jack Antonoff just started recording more and more music until they had Midnights. So that's my album theory for Midnights, is it came about because she and Jack Antonoff had too much fun. And she started recording these songs and thought, oh my gosh, I have a whole new album.
Yeah. I can imagine that. That would be brilliant, because it just things that flow out of the creative overflow of when you're making things and you just have so much creative energy at work. Things just get made, well, you know.
I hope for her sake she does get to rest at some point, because now the Eras Tour with the worldwide tour, and then she's coming back to the US. And so I'm just like, at some point, I hope she sleeps and gets to recover in her body.
Yeah, rest is really, really important. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely right. So thank you, Jenna. Give Jenna a follow on Twitter as well. What's your Twitter handle?
So on Twitter, I'm Jenna, J-E-N-N-A @_DeWitt, DeWitt. And on Threads, and I'm on Instagram as just Jenna DeWitt, no underscore.
And you have a blog, don't you, as well?
I do, yeah. So you should all follow me at InvisibleCakeSociety.com, where I post things like this podcast interview. I post poetry, essays, but mostly it's known for its resource list, where I talk about resources for being a queer Christian, resources for being aromantic and asexual, and I have all sorts of cool contributions from other people as well. So InvisibleCakeSociety.com.
Fantastic. Do check that out. I've had a look at that. It's brilliant. So do check that out. Thank you, Jenna. It's always great to have you on the show. And thanks for listening, everybody.